Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, dedicated to those who believe a car should stir one's emotions and deliver a heightened state of driving. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. The coronavirus outbreak is shining a spotlight on cracks in our healthcare system that existed long before the virus arrived. These cracks are more like gaping holes for some segments of our population, especially minorities. Before the pandemic, North Carolina 12th District Congresswoman Alma Adams set out to address the disparities faced by black women of all economic levels. They are three times as likely to die from pregnancy-related issues than white women, twice as likely to lose an infant to premature death, 22% more likely to die from heart disease, and 71% more likely to perish from cervical cancer. In response, Congresswoman Adams co-founded the Black Maternal Health Caucus, and she joins us this hour to tell us more. Welcome back to the program, Congresswoman.
Thank you very much. It's good to be here, Mike. Thank you for the invitation. It's good to be here with Dr. Oliver as well. We were together for the State of the Union, and it's good to see her again as well.
Well, let me introduce Dr. Oliver. Dr. Pam Oliver is an OBGYN and Executive Vice President of Novant Health up in Winston-Salem, and she joins us from there. Good morning and welcome to you.
Good morning. It's a pleasure to be here with both of you today.
Before we talk about maternal, black maternal health, I'd like to spend some time, just a little bit of time, talking about COVID-19, this pandemic. And prior to the coronavirus outbreak, Congresswoman, you characterized the healthcare disparity among black women as, quote, one of the greatest public health crises of our time. And in light of COVID-19, I have to ask you if you think that's still the case, or given the overrepresentation of black people suffering from this virus, is this just another example of what you're talking about?
Well, it is. It is a critical health crisis in our country. Of course, for black folks now, it just appears to be a double pandemic, and black women are continuing to suffer. And we're seeing that the numbers are continuing to rise as it relates to not only who's getting sick, but who's dying. I mean, we don't have a lot of information about who's getting sick, but of course I think we can surmise that because there've been so many African Americans and people of black and brown people who are dying from this disease, that it is a critical health crisis.
Is that message getting through to the black community that for some reason, and we'll talk about the reasons why you think this is happening, but for those reasons that they are at risk more so than they perhaps believe, is that message getting through, do you think?
Well, I think it's beginning to get through. I think I will tell you that the Congressional Black Caucus, we've had a number of sessions. We meet every week, and it is certainly uppermost on our agenda. We're trying to make sure that people understand the dangers here, and it's about educating our community. But I think it's beginning to resonate. When you see these numbers, you can't help but ignore what's going on.
This virus, as we've said, is infecting more people of color than it is white people. In Chicago last week, Dr. Oliver, more than half of that city's cases were among African Americans, who account for only 30% of the population. In Louisiana, 70% of the cases were among African Americans, who make up a mere 32% of the population. In Mecklenburg County, nearly 44% of the known cases are among black residents, who make up 33% of the population. This is a pattern that is being repeated around the country where the outbreaks are moderate to severe. Some have underlying conditions that exacerbate this virus, but not all do. So what does that tell you, doctor, about why African Americans are succumbing to this at a greater rate than white people?
So Mike, to go back to the data we actually have, what the statistics are around the people we are testing, and we only have the testing capabilities to test our patients who have more moderate to severe disease. So first, we really don't know what percent of Caucasian, African American, Latinas are actually infected with the virus at this point, because we're testing people when they show up to our hospital. hospitals or to our facilities with more severe symptoms. What that data does tell us, because a higher percentage of the patients who are either dying or who are tested and positive at the hospitals are African American, is that the population is at higher risk for more severe disease. And what we've known about COVID is that it does affect people with underlying health conditions like high blood pressure, like diabetes, like asthma. And those conditions, as you mentioned, are higher in prevalence in the African-American community. So if you know, if that in of itself will lead to what we're saying. So shouldn't really surprise us, because when we get to Black maternal mortality, same thing. It's around what is your baseline state of health and how this impacts you.
Well, I was going to say that gets back to, it gets into maternal, Black maternal health. It also gets to just the underlying cause of a lot of this, I think, from what I've read, so you can fill me in on this, Representative Adams, that this is all a part of our long history of racism and inequality that African Americans have lived with for centuries in this country. And the same is true of Black maternal health, correct?
Absolutely. You're absolutely correct. And we have not, over the years, really solved these problems. I think that as we move forward, hopefully we will see this as a necessity and even a greater need now to address some of the some of these issues in these communities, communities where there is you know, we have incredible needs for adequate housing, health care, where we don't have adequate transportation, all those kinds of things. Tend to create problems in these communities, of course. And then when you add that to what's going on now with this virus, you know, so we're at double risk. And I'm assuming now that because the I think we have enough evidence. Of course, we see who's dying, and we also, as Dr. Oliver has said, there are many health issues. But we can work on those things, but I think that there's some things that we can do right now to address what's going on.
You have said, Representative, that the federal government's response to the coronavirus pandemic for all Americans would have been better if the Senate had removed the president from office. So how would you assess his handling of this crisis? And since he's the point, since Vice President Pence is the point man on the task force, how would you assess his performance?
Well, I think I don't really agree with how the president has handled the situation. I think he early on basically set it aside, downplayed it, even in a public way, oh, it's just a hoax and those kinds of things, and didn't take it seriously enough. We acted, I think, not as quickly as we could have in terms of, and then when you look today at as I look at the news each and every day, there were warnings given to the White House. And so they had the information. So they did not act on it. I think the president did not act on it as he should have. I think what I said about that is what many people have said and what many people think. And so I think we have to be realistic and honest about it. Had we acted more quickly in terms of addressing this this pandemic, this virus, we probably would have fewer people who have passed away.
Has Congress done enough? And how would you respond to the president's criticism at his White House update yesterday, in which he accused Democrats of holding back needed legislation to help people through this crisis?
Well, I don't agree with the president. And as a matter of fact, this is not a partisan issue, and he needs to stop making it that. Democrats have worked very vigorously, our Speaker of the House and our leadership with the Senate. As a matter of fact, all of the bills that we passed, and they were all passed in March, there were three of them, they were all bipartisan. This is not a partisan issue. This is a life or death issue. But the president is in his campaign mode. He's using his his daily briefings to do just that. I mean, people can see through it. I wish he would leave the these medical kinds of decisions and so forth and comments to the medical professionals. As you said, he's not a doctor. But we've worked really hard to put money into the community to address this particular issue. Clearly, we still need to do more. We knew when we did what we did that we would have to do more. We're working on a fourth package right now. There's an intermediate emergency package that's a bit in dispute, but it's not because what we want to see is to make sure that the people on the ground, our workers, our healthcare system, that they have the funding that they need as well. I am certainly a supporter of small business. We did that when we put the funding in there, but we want to make sure that the small businesses, each of them, have an opportunity. The moms and pops,
Well, that seems to be a sticky point, because last night there were reports all over the news about small businesses still waiting for the help that Congress passed in that law that was passed and signed by the president, whereas big businesses are getting the money quickly, and they're getting the money with no strings attached, so they can spend that money in the billions of dollars as they see fit. Is this the way the legislation was designed, or is this the way the president has chosen with his signing order to execute that legislation?
Well, certainly it was not the way the laws were written. Certainly it was not the intent of it, but the president has wheeled and dealed, as he continues to like to say, he's going to work a deal. And so he is not adhering to really the spirit of the legislation. We did not expect that the little people, if you will, to be left out of this process. People who are unbanked, people who don't have those banking relationships, still have small businesses, and they need to be provided for as well.
The president has this task force, and he has medical experts on the task force that Vice President Mike Pence is running, including Dr. Fauci and Dr. Birx. But the president is trying to start this second task force of business people and thought leaders who will help him decide when to, quote, open the country, end quote. If he comes up with this economic task force, which he seems to be having a little trouble organizing, but if he comes up with it and that task force says, yep, time to open the country, but the medical task force says, no, not time to open the country, which task force should take precedence?
The medical folks. I mean, the virus is actually leading this thing. I mean, that's going to determine when we can get this leveled off and when it is safe. And that's what the medical professionals are there to do. The president has already said he is not a doctor. He needs to stop being a doctor or trying to be and leave these decisions and up to those medical professionals who are experts. They know what they're talking about, and they are primarily concerned about the health of our communities. And so I'm not sure what the president is concerned about, but obviously he's overlooking that. And that should take precedence, the health of our community and our citizens. Because if you're not healthy, you're not going to be able to go to work.
Representative Alma Adams is from the 12th District. She's also the co-founder of the Black Maternal Health Caucus. When we come back from the break, that's what we're going to talk about Black Maternal Health, because this is Black Maternal Health Week, as luck would have it. Dr. Pam Oliver is also with us from Novant Health. We'll continue in a moment in Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to Mazda's focus to ensure every element of a car is designed around the driver. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Congresswoman Alma Adams from North Carolina's 12th District joins us this morning. She is the co-founder of the Black Maternal Health Caucus in the Congress. Dr. Pam Oliver is also with us, Executive Vice President of Novant Health and also an OBGYN. And I was going to ask, Doctor, if the crux of what we're about to talk about, Black Maternal Health, is based on economics and access to health care, but I come to find out that no, it actually crosses all economic boundaries. I mean, Beyonce has complained about this, of all people. Wealthy Black women face some of the same challenges. Why?
So I think that's one of the most intriguing things about Black maternal health and mortality. We can distill many health disparities, which is what this is, a difference in outcomes for one group of people versus another. We can distill it down to some basic things that go back to socioeconomic status. Is it access to care? Is it education? Is it insurance or cost? And there are definitely factors, those factors that play into Black maternal health that we are addressing. But what we realize is that me as a medical professional, my risk of dying is still higher during pregnancy as a professional African-American woman than a colleague of mine who, or even a Caucasian woman who has a high school degree, right? So it's not all education. It's not about money in that sense. So there is so much more data that's coming out now around the issue of what we call chronic stress and what that does, what does stress, and when it comes down to just whether it's institutional or other types of, you know, racism that can impact one's health and over generations even. So that's one part of it when it comes to, it superseding socioeconomic status and education. And the other factor that we are addressing nationwide, and it was part of some of the bills with Momnibus, is around us understanding our own bias as health professionals and what is already distilled into our medical system. So if I see two patients and treat or advise them differently, and that there's an underlying bias that causes me to do it with one group versus another, it will and could lead to adverse outcomes for one group. And so we actively, all of us have bias. It doesn't matter. African Americans have bias, you know, Caucasians have bias. And so it's just something we have to own that exists and deal with. But it's important for us in the health community to acknowledge it and to monitor it and to hold each other accountable when we see it.
In the beginning of this program, I threw out some statistics, Representative Adams, that Black women are three times as likely to die from pregnancy-related issues than white women, twice as likely to lose an infant to premature death, 22% more likely to die from heart disease, 71% more likely to die from cervical cancer. I'm sure that those statistics are a surprise to many of our listeners. Would they be a surprise to people in the Black community?
Well, we're trying to get the word out so that it's not a surprise. And I think sometimes even within our own communities, we're surprised about things. So I would say that we're becoming more engaged in this whole process of educating our community. I think initially it probably was a surprise and could be a surprise that so many Black women are even dying, giving birth, and even having issues after they give birth to a healthy child. So I think as we have continued to talk about this issue, people have said, well, I didn't know that. And some people that look like me have said that. Women who look like me have said that. And so this is why we're compiling the stories. We'll hear some of them this evening as we get into our forum on Black maternal care. So I think initially people are surprised, but we're hoping to take that surprise element out of it so that people really understand what could happen to them so that they can certainly take the steps necessary to avoid it.
Would there be people, doctor, in the medical community, OBGYNs, other doctors, heart specialists, etc., would they be surprised by these statistics?
I think when we go through, I know that all of us, when we go through med school, we get lectures on various parts of the body or areas. And in almost all of those, it is highlighted this group. And a lot of times it is African-Americans are higher risk, or this is the disproportionate share of that diagnosis in a community. So I know that we've all been exposed to it. I would say that most of us would think, well, that's probably happening somewhere else. That's not in my patient community. That obviously doesn't have anything to do with me. So I do think that it would be eye-opening to people and is when we actually pull back the covers and look at truly what's happening either in specific practices or at the institutional level.
It gets worse than the statistics that I just pointed out. It's hard to believe that it can get worse, but it does, because although Black women have worse outcomes than women in general, what makes this so much more alarming to me is that the United States has the worst maternal death rate in the developed world, and that rate continues to rise. We experience 18 deaths per 100,000 live births. For black women, it is twice as bad, 40 deaths per 100,000 live births. Why, in the richest country in the world, in a country that we are constantly told has the best healthcare system in the world, the envy of the world, how is it possible that we have this record?
Right. So I think that when we look at the numerous factors for this, so there are obviously some of our patients who do not have good access. So even though we are the wealthiest country in the world, there's still a significant portion of our community that either doesn't have access because of proximity, how far they have to drive, or can they get to a healthcare provider? Lack or of insurance coverage or underinsured, so the out-of-pocket cost or their ability to afford healthcare and consistent prenatal care is an issue. We have seen that in states that have expanded Medicaid, that there has been significant reduction in maternal mortality and in infant mortality. So we have to understand that access plays into this. And then I think the rest of the for those that I said where it supersedes socioeconomics, et cetera, we have to make sure education-wise that we acknowledge that risk. It is the underlying health conditions, and many of those we now are realizing have to do with the what is specific or what is nuanced about the United States. And it does have to go, it goes back to our social structures and the way that we deal with race in this country.
It's also not just access, although access plays a role in this. This is a personal issue for you, Representative Adams, because your daughter had two difficult pregnancies. And then when your granddaughter had a problem, she kept telling the doctors, "I have a problem." She knew her body and she knew something was wrong, and they didn't treat her. She almost died. How can this be?
Well, it shouldn't be. Let me first of all say that. But I think much of what you'll hear when you talk to women who have had these difficulties, if they have lived to be able to tell it, they aren't listened to. We know our bodies, and oftentimes when you are sharing things with your doctor and you go and you say, "Well, it's bothering me here. I don't know what it is, but I know it's something." And sometimes, many times, too many times, it's dismissed. So I think it's just not listening to women. Black women, in particular, have said to me, "I was trying to tell them." And then when I think about even the bill that I have in this omnibus series, there are nine bills there, the Kira Johnson Act. Kira is an example of what I'm talking about. She is no longer here. She suffered 12 hours after giving birth to a healthy baby boy, her second son, and they kept telling her husband was there, her mom, her mother-in-law, all of her advocates, and in recovery, they were in her room. They were telling her, "Well, it looks like there's blood going into her catheter. Let's do something." And they just continued, "Oh, well, we'll take care of it. We'll take care of it." 12 hours passed, and she died. That was unnecessary. And so you have a lot of Kira Johnsons. You have a lot of Janelle Lindsay's, my daughter, who had difficulty after birth. So it's not always during the delivery. But she was home for several weeks. We have other stories where this happens, and you go back and you talk to doctors, and they dismiss it. But I think that's one of the things that they don't feel that they're listened to. As Dr. Oliver has mentioned, their biases, we all have them. We may not know that we have them, but we've got to certainly address those. And it's extremely difficult for Black women in this regard.
I mentioned that this is, we're in the middle, literally in the middle of Black Maternal Health Week. And at the announcement of this week on Capitol Hill, Senator Kamala Harris joined you, Representative Adams, and others. And one of the things that Senator Harris said was that, quote, "We must continue in the fight to ensure Black women are taken seriously when they speak about their health concerns and remove disparities and implicit bias from our healthcare system." We've heard in recent years that the healthcare concerns of women in general are often minimized by healthcare professionals. Doctor, is this a part of that, or is this something different and deeper in some way?
I think it's along the same vein, but probably deeper, as you mentioned. You know, I think what we acknowledge in healthcare and need to embrace and do, you know, we're doing lots with it now, but need to do more, is we have to see every person and patient as important. And so a lot of the, when we talk about taking people seriously, especially based on their racial or socioeconomic status, it is, I value every person the same. So if you have a complaint, if Congresswoman Adams has a complaint, that I take those and weigh those in the same way. And I think that what we have concerns about just historically is that it is easy for people sometimes to depersonalize care, to not see someone as, you know, as important. And I don't think that this happens, you know, for the majority of my colleagues. I will say I am proud to be part of the health profession where we continue to evolve. We own the things that we can improve on and are tackling that. But I think a big part of that just societally has to be we value everyone and what they, when they speak up, we value as a person equally.
Representative Adams, your co-founder of this Black Maternal Health Caucus is Lauren Underwood of Illinois, and she says the statistics around Black maternal health are horrifying, her words, and they haven't improved in 30 years as maternal health outcomes overall have gotten worse. Is this the result just of implicit bias or of racism? Is it a result of economics, of lack of access to health care, health insurance, or just a combination, a perfect storm of all of those things?
Well, I think it all of those things certainly contribute. Not in every case, though. Congresswoman Underwood had a friend. As a matter of fact, that's the one I just spoke about, Kira Johnson. Very good friend of hers is this young woman, well-educated, two PhDs, great health insurance and that kind of thing. So it doesn't matter how much money you have, doesn't matter what your, what side of town you live in, doesn't matter, those things don't matter. But yes, all of those things that you mentioned, I think factor in sometimes. But in that particular case, she, what really was not listened to. There was a cesarean that she had for this second child. And of course we see that there are many, many problems as it relates to that. They're actually having more cesareans, I understand, and I'm not that kind of doctor, but with Black women. So we have a lot of things I think that we need to look at as it relates to that. But I agree with Congresswoman Underwood. It is serious. It is horrifying to all of us when we learn of these statistics and the fact that they haven't improved over decades. And that's what this caucus is about, to try to make sure that we do address the problem in very productive ways.
We've been talking about implicit bias and unrecognized racism in people in society at large when it comes to law enforcement and the criminal justice system and other aspects of American life as well. But Doctor, how do you address structural deficiencies and bias and systemic racism within the healthcare system? Where do you begin?
So education is key for this. And so first, our first conversations are with our teams, whether it's our physicians, our nurse practitioners and physician assistants, and every member of our team around what this is, because it's difficult for some to even acknowledge that this is an issue. So we start with just acknowledgement and education. And we have a program internally that we have launched and have piloted to improve. And it is to allow people to understand. And it's about recognition. I don't think there's any way for implicit bias for you to wipe it completely out. I wish that there was a way for us to say you can get a degree and you're now over this and you never will, it will never be part of your thinking. Because like I said, all of us have it. But it is important for us to recognize it, and it is a way for us to, the programs we have allow you to understand how to check your thinking and to assess it. And then data, we actually, you know, we collect data on health outcomes. I think that data is getting more advanced. I wouldn't say we have significant amount of it at a local level, but just sharing with people, here are your outcomes. Let's look into this and let's figure out how to problem solve.
Yeah. One study reports that white families, which comprise about 77% of the population, hold 90% of the nation's wealth. Black families make up 13% of the population and have 2.6% of the nation's wealth. Black unemployment has consistently been twice that of whites over the last 60 years, in good times and in bads, and that includes African Americans with college degrees. We also know that they get disproportionate treatment in the criminal justice system and elsewhere. I would take it that all of this plays a role in maternal health, does it not?
Absolutely. I will say, so one of the most humbling things I think for the medical community over the last several years is we were able to define what we call social determinants of health in a way that helped us to acknowledge, as a physician, I often think that the outcome for my patient has everything to do with what pill did I give them? What treatment did I offer? How did I take care of them when I saw them? What was my impact on them? What's been very humbling is that we know that medical care is probably 10 to 20% of the outcome. And the rest of it has everything to do with what you mentioned. It is, do I have safe housing? And safe is important. What are the stressors that I experience in my communities? Do I have access to care? Do I have food so I can treat my diabetes appropriately? Can I afford my medicines? And that all goes back to economic empowerment. And so we could go on and on probably about why that is. You know, what are the policies over time that have led to some of this? But a huge step forward has to be acknowledging that we will not improve health outcomes nationally until we start to address the underlying socioeconomic policies and factors in our communities.
And these policies have been in place for at least a century and maybe much more than a century. But this, as you say, this is bigger than just health care. There are barriers to that health care, including housing and transportation and paid leave and hunger and the environment. And when we come back, because this is so complex, I want to know if anybody has a roadmap to get us out of this and towards something better. We're talking to Congresswoman Alma Adams from the 12th Congressional District in North Carolina and Dr. Pam Oliver, an OBGYN and Vice President of Novant Health. We'll continue in a moment. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're here with Representative Alma Adams from the 12th Congressional District in North Carolina, representing most of, if not all of Mecklenburg County, most of it at least. And she's also the co-founder of the Black Maternal Health Caucus in the Congress. Dr. Pam Oliver is with us. She's an executive vice president of Novant Health and an OBGYN. So we talked about all of these underlying factors in the African American community that have held people back over the years: redlining, lack of access to a good job, equal pay, hunger, paid leave, housing. All of this leads into not being able to get adequate health care. So it's so complex, and it involves so many different things. Congresswoman, does anybody have a roadmap or an idea of how to draw a roadmap or a timeline on how we get out of this?
Well, I think we have to address those issues. We do have to, one of the things that I've tried to do through my legislative work is to look at four areas, what I call the four H's: hunger, housing, healthcare, and education, higher education more specifically, because that's kind of where my career has been. But I think we do have to, if you don't have adequate health care, if you don't have a decent, affordable, safe place to live, if you don't have access to food, we have a lot of food deserts in many of our communities. And we have a large number of people, more than 165,000, who are food insecure right here in my district. And of course, this pandemic exacerbates that because in terms of people being able to access the food, many of our young people, our students, for example, were fed at school, may not get the kinds of meals that they need at home. So all of those things factor in. So I think we're going to have to address not just as a Congress, but I think collectively on the local, the state, and the federal level, working with our partners like our health professionals and so forth. But I think we can create a roadmap to doing that. And I think what this pandemic has uncovered is what has really pulled the covers off. I mean, these are things that we knew already, but it will, I think, give us an opportunity to realistically go back and address these things. And I think we should do. We have a moral obligation, I believe, to do that.
And do you think that this pandemic that we're going through right now, which is revealing that the cracks that we kind of knew we had are actually chasms for some people, do you think this will change people's minds about the nature of healthcare and about whether it is a right or whether it is something that you can get if you can afford it?
Well, I've always believed that healthcare is a right. I even tried to, I had some legislation to try to put it in the Constitution to make healthcare, to housing, and many of those things that I mentioned as rights. Everybody has a right to affordable healthcare. Everybody has a right, I believe, to a decent, affordable place to live. All of these things should be rights. Hopefully they will, we will have learned some things as a result of this process. I don't believe that because you should not be denied healthcare because you don't have the income. It is not a partisan issue. Everybody, if you live, Lord spares you, you're going to get sick and you're going to need to see a doctor. And the pain that you have is not going to be determined as to whether or not it's a Democrat pain or Republican pain or no party affiliation at all. So it is essential. I think about Martin Luther King's comments that of all of the inequities, the inequality in healthcare is the most vicious. I mean, that wasn't the word that he used, but clearly it is. And we really need to address that. It is the most inhumane, I think, is the word that he used.
One of the things, Doctor, that Representative Adams has pointed out as part of her caucus is that the complications and conditions that Black women from all socioeconomic levels suffer from and are dying from are, and this is shocking, preventable. 60%, 60% of maternal deaths are preventable. What needs to change to change that?
So what we know about maternal mortality in general, there are two conditions that lead to the most mortality or deaths. One is hemorrhage or bleeding after pregnancy. So every woman has a risk of significant bleeding after she delivers. And early recognition is key. And that's where going back to what are we seeing and taking everyone at, uniformly as seriously everyone's symptoms. So if I pay attention to how much bleeding someone's saying they're having or the nurse is reporting they're having, if I act more quickly on it. So across the board nationwide, you see our societies in OBGYN and our hospitals moving to more aggressive protocols to address it early. We actually know for African-American women that one of the having fibroid uterine fibroids, which are little growths in the uterus, increases that rate of hemorrhage. And it just happens to be that we come into pregnancy with fibroids more often. It's just more common in African-American women. So that in of itself sets us up for a higher risk of having bleeding. And then regardless of fibroids or not, us recognizing it early is important. And the second part, the second condition has to do with hypertension and high blood pressure. So if we come into pregnancy either with high blood pressure, which we do more often in the African-American community, regardless of age even, we're more prone to develop those type of hypertensive conditions in pregnancy. Early recognition and treatment are key. So that boils down. It has to be with how we train our teams to take all those symptoms seriously early.
How much of it has also to do with lack of access to prenatal care?
So the access is key for prenatal care when it comes not just to the maternal outcomes, but also for our infant mortality, which we see higher infant mortality in North Carolina than we do in other states. So yes, early access, consistency in access, and I think value in it. A big part of our campaigns are around educating the entire community about the importance of prenatal care. So we are doing a significant amount to say, you know, we're here. We want to have a diverse team so that people trust, you know, have trust in the teams that they're coming to see and feel that, you know, we have their health and in mind, and making sure it's affordable. So expanding programs and working together. So I wouldn't touch all the politics, but I think from a policy perspective, just valuing that access absolutely matters.
Elected officials in Congress, Congresswoman, are members of various different caucuses. Caucuses are not committees. They are not, I don't believe they have any legal standing within the Congress. They can't pass laws. I guess they can help write them. Explain to me what a caucus does, because the Black Maternal Health Caucus is another caucus. What do they do? How do they operate?
Well, first of all, these are individuals who have common interests in something. We have a bicycle caucus. We've got a brandy caucus. We've got a wine. We got all kind of caucuses. We have an art caucus. We have a diabetes caucus. I'm on many of the health caucuses. But this is, gives members an opportunity outside of committee to meet and to discuss issues. But at the same time, and when we look specifically at the Black Maternal Health Caucus, it's a lot like many others who then translate many of the things, many of the interests that they have into legislation. Then we build on getting support for that. In our caucus, for example, we have men and women. We're really now a year old because we were started in April of last year. And it's huge. I mean, we have a lot of men, and many of the programs that we have put together with professionals in the in healthcare, they have we have built coalitions who have helped us, for example, even with the Momnibus. So the caucuses are good. They're good advocacy groups within within the walls of Congress. And then I think from the discussions of many of the caucuses, good legislation comes out.
Well,
and
your caucus was formed in April of last year, and also in April of last year, you co-sponsored the Maternal Health Quality Improvement Act. Was that your, did that come from you, or did that come as a result of your operation within the caucus?
well, it came from both. I mean, you know, it was some ideas that we had. I mean, I think that I think that's the good thing about a caucus. That means that people are getting together, they're thinking, they're talking, they're sharing ideas, and then ultimately these things become legislation. And one of the good things that we did, you mentioned Senator Harris a few minutes ago, when we can then bring the legislation across chambers, then it's more likely to get support and to get it passed, because nothing becomes law until it clears the House and the Senate,
Right.
and then it also is signed by the president. So that's kind of a strategic way of really getting things done outside of committees.
Your caucus also sent through a list of priorities through Congress in a House appropriations bill last year. It included billions of dollars in research money, millions of dollars in grants for education, and for education. What happened to that legislation? Did it get through the Senate?
Well, it gets through it. Well, nothing has gotten much through the Senate.
That's right.
To say that, I'm grateful that they were certainly supportive of the stimulus packages that we did, because we all had an interest in that, and I think that's really what compromise is all about. But some of those initiatives get put into the budget in other ways. So I would say yes, we have increased support for the various health agencies that we have. So yes, some of it has gotten through. They don't always it doesn't always come through as that particular bill. My interest is let's if we can get the issue in there, if we can get the support in there, then that's a good thing. When you look at stimulus, we wanted to have the testing free. We also wanted to have the the carefree, which right now that's what we need to go back, because there was no treatment in that. But you know, you win some, you lose some, but we really need to go back. We shouldn't have lost the treatment aspect, because if you end up with this virus and you are found to be positive, you still need some way to be treated. So I think we have to, so there are a lot of things that we have to do, but it's all about compromise and working together. And I think that caucuses are a good way to really get that conversation started.
So Dr. Representative Adams wants this caucus to develop evidence-based, culturally competent policies and best practices to achieve better health outcomes. Is that information, these facts about, I don't know, competent policies and best practices readily available in the healthcare world? Would this evidence be easy to compile and deliver? Would it be easily accepted by the healthcare world if it's coming from the political world?
Well, I would say this is one of those, whether it comes down to maternal mortality or it comes down to COVID, it's going to take all of us to working together. So I would say, yes, we still embrace, the CDC, the governmental information that we get. We all work together in this. So I would say, yes, it would be embraced. I think that with many things, we just want to make sure that the policies we're getting or the information we're getting is well vetted and has no angle that has to do with politics, but it's truly about policy, right? And I think that's exactly what the solutions that have been offered up achieve. So we trust that we have to work together in this, and I think that we would very much embrace the assistance we need. I think that COVID has actually shown a light on the fact that, you know, there's a significant role that government plays in all aspects of our life. Whether you believe big government, small government, doesn't matter. We need some level of state and federal and local support when it comes to tackling these health crises.
So to make headway on this issue, to make a difference on this issue, does the impetus have to come from Washington, or does it have to come from the healthcare industry?
I wouldn't say that it has to come from Washington. I think there needs to be support at the federal level. I would say that, you know, even with COVID specifically, what we have all battled with in healthcare a little bit is figuring it out and trying to fend for ourselves when it comes to our supplies or our testing abilities. And so I think that in that sense, this is one of those areas where we want to dive in. We've coordinated with our other health systems in our areas to align on how we can take care of the community. We have done that without regard to, are we getting paid for some of this stuff, because we value our role in that. But when it comes to things like supplies, we really, you know, would benefit from us bargaining as a nation for those supplies versus as individual systems. So I feel like we all play a role, and Washington and CDC and the national agencies have a huge place in supporting us and helping guide us. And then we take it and run from there.
The National Medical Association, which is the largest and oldest organization of black physicians in the United States, has some recommendations for expectant black mothers. They say, when mothers see or experience bias or racism in a clinic setting or in the hospital, they should call it out. They recommend those women learn about the conditions that increase the risk for pregnancy-related death. They encourage them to have at least 4 prenatal doctor visits. They encourage breastfeeding after having a baby to minimize bleeding. And they are promoting post-delivery care for both mother and baby. You agree with all those things, doctor?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Okay. And I think, you know, one of the things that we recognize, the breastfeeding part of that is huge, and have done everything we can to make sure we have access and increase those rates.
And believe it or not, a non-politician gets the last word. I can't believe it. Dr. Pam Oliver, the Executive Vice President of Novant Health and an OBGYN, thank you for joining us. And Alma Adams, representative from the 12th Congressional District in North Carolina and the co-founder of the Black Maternal Health Health Caucus within the Congress. Thank you both for the hour, and stay safe. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to drivers that share Mazda's passion that cars make driving matter. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.